Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Up North News with Pat Kreitlow starts now.
Well, here we are, kind of, sort of. So, we're having a little audio gremlins today at the Lake Wasota studio, but we'll work on those. So, welcome. Hope you all had a good weekend. It's Monday, September 26th. Among our guests this morning scheduled, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Jill Underley, in our 10 a.m. hour to discuss her recent State of Education address. State Senator Kelda Royce joins us in our 9 a.m. hour, and we'll talk about the kinds of things the legislature could be doing to help the state cope with a labor shortage. And coming up shortly, Scott Ross, former executive director of One Wisconsin Now, one of the groups that was truly a pioneer in calling attention to the rapidly rising amount of student loan debt in the U.S., something that President Joe Biden finally did something about. Sports-wise, quite a weekend. Packers, well, you had two teams without the offensive weapons they're used to, and our defense was able to hold Tom Brady by and large, although it definitely didn't look like it in the final minute when Brady went in for a touchdown, but then they couldn't convert the two-point conversion, and Packers hang on for a win. But that was more of a nail-biter than I would have liked at the end there.
Yeah, when the Packers have a hard time scoring in the second half, like, this has kind of been the trend for the last couple of years now, where they can get a lead and they can play good defense, and then they almost waste the lead, and because they just can't put the final nail in the coffin, and it's a bummer.
And if this sounds familiar at all, it's because we've been dealing with this for the entire baseball season. The Brewers they could not get any offense going, especially in the second half of the game, and at a time when they really can't afford losing to a bad Cincinnati team by one run. That's exactly what they do Sunday, losing 2-1. So now every one of these final games, all at home, matter if they're hoping to make the playoffs. They've got St. Louis, Miami, and Arizona before all is said and done. Badger football team went to Ohio State, and the completely expected happened. 52-21 was the final. And, you know, this is a team that finished the first half with 328 yards and a 31-7 lead over the Badgers. So the signs were already there that things were going to go according to expectations, and they did. Before we get to the news close to home, I just want to say here, and I understand that there's virtually nobody listening with a connection to the Cayman Islands besides me, having lived there for about 3 years, just about almost a decade ago now. But there are a lot of friends who are in harm's way right now as Hurricane Ian passes and just narrowly misses Grand Cayman. But I've been looking at the feeds of the, you know, the wind and the rain, and watching everybody's stories about hunkering down and preparing. And so I'm wishing them all the best. And the only thing I want to add to that for a Wisconsin audience is, you know, when we have this chance to live overseas for a short time, of course we are very excited. We knew well enough when looking for an apartment not to get one on the ground floor. We understood hurricanes that well. So we did get a place on the second floor. And like a couple of good little firstborns, we were, you know, more than happy to prepare a hurricane safety kit, which is, you know, actually just kind of a big tub, you know, storage tub that you fill with all manner of things. And then, of course, you know, several gallons of fresh water just in case. All that was fine. It was when we got down near the end of the list that things got a little weird and put things in perspective. Of all the things in the hurricane kit that you don't have in an emergency kit here, when you get to the part on the list where it says life preservers, and that gets your attention. And maybe it wouldn't have pre-Katrina. Maybe I would have thought, oh, you know, that kind of thing, blah, blah, blah. Once you have a hurricane that basically has swept 1,000 people out to sea or so, and drowned people in their homes and have them swept off their rooftops, you then understand why even inside an apartment, you know, in a beautiful place, you need to keep life preservers handy. Ivan in 2004, I want to say 2005, was a category five that had a direct hit on Grand Cayman. And they were just barely done with all of the cleanup when we moved there in 2014. And all of the stories were the same. Basically, the island disappeared for several hours because of the storm surge. And everybody has a story of basically being up on their kitchen counters. It was as if the entire island was covered by about 4 feet of water. And you either had to be on a kitchen counter or on a table or, you know, upstairs if you were lucky enough to have that. And again, it's not like we don't have tornadoes here, not like we don't have blizzards. But when you don't live with that, that really caught your attention. And the other thing people talked about all the time was, again, the hours and hours of not just a howling wind, but a screaming wind. And it just, it gets you after a while, they say. But they came through it. They rebuilt, of course, and hopefully things go well there, because then we turn our attention to Florida and the Panhandle and what other areas might be affected next. And certainly we hope for all the best for everybody that might be impacted. Scott Ross is our guest for the next hour. Coming up after this break, you're Up North. Going to start trolling me right from the get-go today. Did you know that this is Kenny Loggins? Not Michael Douglas, but Michael McDonald, but Michael McDonald sings in the background on this? You probably knew that. He's feeling really full of himself right now because, as you know, it probably sounds different than the way the show started when we had some microphone difficulties here. And as I'm looking at all the various settings and things, Luke, what was your very scientifically based high-tech answer?
60% of the time, it works every time. But all you got to do is unplug it and plug it back in.
Yeah. So unplug the microphone interface, plug it back in, works like a dream. Here we are. So again, our apologies for kind of some rough audio in the very beginning. But now we get to enjoy the dulcet tones of one Scott Ross joining us from, I believe, from the Madison area. Or where are you these days, Scott?
Yep. Yes, I am in Madison, Pat, and it's great to be here. It's great to see you. Good to hear Luke is still feisty as ever.
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. Anyway, we were going to cover a couple of different things here, but the original reason and the main reason that I really want to focus on is student loan debt and the way that you and others helped play a leadership role years ago in telling people, hey, I don't think y'all understand how fast this is growing and you know how much it is you know a bad thing for local economies. But I can't start there first because we're in the throes of an election campaign, and there's something else going on that's very reminiscent of another battle that One Wisconsin Now fought for all those years that you were executive director there, and it deals with what there is. There's no other way to say that these are downright racist campaign ads that are running. And I talked for a little bit on the radio, I think Friday, about the work that you and others did trying to find the funding source of racist voter intimidation billboards in Milwaukee exactly 10 years ago. And I thought it would be great to just go right to the source and have you talk about what happened then, what you learned, and what your impressions are as it carries over to campaign ads today. I know that's rather open-ended, but you've done a lot of work trying to expose people on this. So, I mean, where would you like to start in talking first about the voter intimidation billboards from back then?
Well, I mean, you may, if your listeners don't remember, back in 2010, when Scott Walker was on the ballot for the first time as governor, there were billboards that showed up on the I-94 interchange between Madison and Milwaukee, and then around Milwaukee in the city, saying that voter fraud is a felony and is a $10,000 fine, 3.5 years in prison. And it was financed according to the disclaimer on it by a private family foundation. And those billboards showed up all over the place. If you remember, Pat, 2010 was kind of a disaster for Democrats who were running for elected office. And so in the midst of, you know, what appeared to be just a coming nightmare electorally for Democrats, which in fact it was, that who was funding those billboards wasn't so much an issue, but just that the billboards were up there alleging voter fraud. And we had had in 2010 also, I don't know if you remember this or not, but One Wisconsin Now obtained a secret audio recording of the Tea Party groups at the time, the Americans for Prosperity and the Republican Party of Wisconsin, which was run by Rance Priebus at the time, where they got together at a resort and discussed a illegal voter caging scheme to try and prevent voters from being able to vote and creating long lines in polling places in the inner city of Milwaukee and around the student areas. And it, just to what voter caging is it's this illegal practice that Republicans have predominantly been, they're exclusively the ones that do, where they send, where they would send letters to voters in apartment buildings and places like that that required them to get the letter physically, or the letter would go back to the sender. Then they would take that list of voters and they would go to their polling places on election day. And when those voters showed up, they'd say, oh, wait, they don't live here. I sent them a letter and this letter came back. And that would create these enormous, enormous lines at polling places in the inner cities. So, and people would end up going home instead of voting. And this thing, you know, Pat, before it was about screaming about voter fraud, it was about creating long lines. You know, back in the 1960s, dead Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist, a proud Shorewood Milwaukee graduate, was in charge of this project that started out in Arizona in the 1960s to deny people of color the right to vote. It was a racist scheme then. It has been the hallmark. Denying black and brown people the right to vote has been a hallmark of the Republican voting strategy. And I know I've gone in a roundabout way to get this, but they've done so much. You know, we're going to, you know, if you want to talk about it, let's talk about it. And again, we had experienced that. And so we were focusing on that. And meanwhile, this private family foundation puts up this billboard, very obviously racist billboard. And that was that in 2010. It was a nightmare. Democrats got shellacked. Scott Walker came into office. A lot of lunatics got into office, including Ron Johnson. And okay, fine. Fast forward to 2012 when Barack Obama is on the ballot for reelection. These billboards showed back up both in Wisconsin and in Ohio. And that was when we started to say, wait a second, who is this? Who is financing this? And I love this so much. I love it so much. Because the way that we started our pursuit, which inevitably led to the Bradley Foundation being the funders of this, is that, you know, whitewashed, you know, right-wing Republican racist media darling Charlie Sykes was on his radio show and he was blathering that he had talked to the person who had created the billboards, you know, who'd financed the billboards, and they were just, you know, these weren't meant to do this, and we were just trying to inform people, blah, 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 blah. And as soon as they said Charlie Sykes, I'm like, we need to scour the Bradley Foundation finance reports to find this. You know, let's go back to 2010, because Charlie Sykes was like, you know, an agent of the Bradley Foundation, which, if your listeners don't know, is the biggest source of right-wing, white nationalist, anti-Muslim, Islamophobic funding in the state of Wisconsin. Or I'm sorry, on the planet. My bad. The planet. They loop their C3 funding, looped the Koch brothers. It looped a whole bunch of other entities. And so we started looking at, you know, the Bradley Foundation gives out $30 to $40 million a year. So we looked at their 990s, which is how they spent their money. And lo and behold, we found a $10,000 gift from the Bradley Foundation to this other foundation in Milwaukee, the Einhorn Family Foundation. And that was how we made the connection. We started working with Joy Reid at MSNBC, who was then a reporter at the Griot, because she reached out to us to say, who do you think financed this? We were able to figure this out. And she was able to get confirmation once we were able to get to that point. And so that's what happened. I think the only reason it didn't become national news is the day that her story came out was when Hurricane Sandy hit New York. So I'll take a breath.
No, it's very enlightening to hear the various tactics over the years, from the 60s through the voter caging and now the voter intimidation billboards. And look, TV advertising isn't new, and race baiting in TV advertising isn't new, but it is at such a level now here in Wisconsin, because a black man is on the ticket running for U.S. Senate, who has said nice things about other women of color, you know, who are currently in the United States Congress, that if you're any of the people that you've just described that engage in these schemes, I hate to sound charitable to them, but how do you not go that route with your TV ads when you can't really win on the issues?
Well, I don't, you know, I would never... I understand what you're saying. It's despicable and disgusting.
Right.
And it has been an assault. And I was just reading a story in the Washington Post, because I started to subscribe to the Washington Post for a year because one of my favorite reporters went to work there. And there was an enormous story on this specific topic about Ron Johnson's racist ads. And it expanded and it went into, you know, Marco Rubio, who's the senator who's, you know, one of the most repellent U.S. senators, one of the most, you know, just craven, you know, he makes Lindsey Graham seem, you know, reserved in his craven duplicity. But they talked about he's running, you know, Marco Rubio's running for Senate again. He's being challenged by a black former police, you know, chief. And they're going after her for being soft on crime in the exact same way she, you know, and she's black as well. Like, we cannot... I think that we allow patty cakes to be played with the media in the way in which they discuss these things. And they let it gets to go for 3 or 4 weeks or 5 weeks before, like, there's finally the quote unquote backlash story where, oh yeah, Democrats are saying this is racist. You know, Democrats have been saying the Mandela Barnes ads have been racist since they came out of the Klan in which they were, you know, created. And so, it's that whole thing of, like, you know, it takes a lie 5 seconds, you know, before you tell the truth, you can get the truth out there. The lie has circled the planet 5 times. And I think when it comes to racism and these racist ads, this is exactly the same thing. I mean, it is an onslaught. I mean, there's probably been, I would say, against Mandela in the last, like, couple weeks, $12 to $15 million of racist ads. And at the same time, you see, like, his numbers falling down. Like you say, it works. It's disgusting. It's despicable. It works. And it's going to continue to work until we find a way in which we can be more upfront. And, you know, as white Democrats, be able to talk about race, because a lot of us cower from it. Let's just call it the way it is. A lot of white Democrats, especially electeds, cower from having a discussion about calling out the Republicans for being racist. It's as simple as that.
By the time they do, like you said, the inertia in media is such. I always come back to somewhat related, the whole notion of rigging the maps and gerrymandering. We knew right away in 2011, those maps were rigged in a way that had never been done before. The media would not use the word gerrymandered, would not use the word rigged. Now they use it like secondhand. Yeah. Everybody knows it is, but it took cycles, multiple cycles, rather than calling it out at the time.
Yeah, but I can't say for gerrymandering if this is the case, but when it comes to racism, it's because elected officials won't call their colleagues racist. That's one of the big, huge problems that Democrats have, is that we will not, you know, and it's funny because you see, like, you know, my new state rep, Fran Hong, called Robin Voss out for being a racist, and he squealed about it. He squealed. And, like, rather than other people making the most powerful Republican in the state of Wisconsin squeal more, like, people start backing off from it, you know, and that's nonsense, because he is the architect. He is the person in charge of it. Any racist ad that is out there about the state legislature, he is in charge of. And it's simple as that. And they need to be called out on this. And as do their leaders, you know, up and down the food chain.
and not just calling them out, but the funders as well. I know we certainly have tried as much as we can to let people know about, you know, Wisconsin Truth Pack, and that is solely the creation of a couple of billionaires who directly benefited from a Ron Johnson tax cut. We have Scott Ross with us, former executive director of One Wisconsin Now. We are going to get back to the student loan debt issue as well and talk about, you know, what a benefit that is. And yet those the benefits are not being communicated nearly as much because of a very powerful Republican messaging machine. That's all coming up after this break. You're up north.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
Tomorrow on the program, attorney Mark Thompson, a member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and Up North News reporter Christina Laurie about her recent interview with former White House photographer Pete Souza. Scott Ross joins us now for the second half of this hour of Up North News for Monday, September 26th. Let's go ahead and make the pivot now, Scott, and again, going back to the very beginning, which again is many years back now, but You did kind of have almost like a eureka moment or a genesis moment of recognizing that student loan debt was a big problem and that it was basically unrepresented in political circles and in media messaging.
Well, thank you for asking about this, Pat. Back in 2000, I looked it up a while ago, and the first time that we complained at One Wisconsin Now about student loan debt was in 2008. And after, again, the debacle of 2010 and moving forward, we were like, you know, there were four or five of us in the office, and three of us had current student loan debt, including me, and I'm 1,000 years old. And so we said, I wonder if there's something that is in there, you know, in there in which to talk about, because, you know, we had a list of about 11 philosophies at One Wisconsin Now. And one of them was, I use my wallet every day. And that being that, you know, all issues you got to bring back and you can bring back to economics in some way, shape or form. And that's what would motivate people to want to go to the polls, because we wanted a large group of participants in the electoral process. And we felt that people with, you know, we started thinking like, well, do people who have student loan debt, are they staying home because there's nothing they can do about this? Because it's never happened before. You know, like my generation, you're sort of on the cut. You're right there. We've always grandfathered you in as a Gen Xer because you were born in 1964.
Oh, thank you.
You know, but, you know, Gen Xers are the first generation that had multiple decades of student loan debt. And, you know, the Youngs are even worse than us. And so when we first started talking about student debt, Pat, and you and I know you and I talked about this, I'd have old people who were like, well, when I went to college, I worked. And I'm like, you know what? Nobody with student loan debt doesn't work. Like, you know, everybody worked. I mean, I was a janitor when I was in college and worked for the newspaper. Like, everybody works. It's not about that. It's about the fact that, you know, the investment that we make in higher education, the government investment has reduced substantially. And in fact, back in 1990, 10 cents of every general purpose revenue dollar in the state budget went to higher education. And by the time Walker was done, it was like something like 2.9 cents to, you know, something like, you know, some ridiculous reduction in that. At the same time, of course, Tommy Thompson and Scott Walker's racist correction policies took us from $186 million biennial budget in 1986 when Tommy took over to a $1 billion corrections budget. I mean, think about that. We went from $186 billion to $186 million to $1 billion. We, in the 1990s in Wisconsin, our percentage of increase in correction spending was 550%, the largest in the country. Number two was Pennsylvania, at just 275%. That's the corrections explosion that happened, the racist corrections explosion. That, of course, like, you know, again, another thing that the press would never, ever talk about was Scott Walker's racist correction policy, because he was in charge of the election, assembly corrections committee for all those years. But anyhow, back to student loan debt. Sorry, I digressed. No. We said, what can we do about this? What can we, you know, let's look into this. So the first thing we did, Pat, was we put together this enormous research project because we thought about what are the things that if you had, what are middle class purchases that people with student loan debt who in the past when they didn't have student debt could pay for, and what can't they pay for now, and how does that work with the economy? And we found in this groundbreaking science that if you have a student loan debt, you are twice as likely to have a used as opposed to a new car, and you are twice as likely to rent or live with your parents than own that embodiment of the middle class, a home of your own. So people who were trying to get into the middle class and doing education, and again, these are hardworking student loan borrowers who did the right thing. They weren't asking for a handout. They were just asking to be treated fairly in a system that treated them unfairly. You know, they took on the personal responsibility for financing their higher education, and they were being denied that because of not just the ghastly increase in higher education, but that every consumer protection that's afforded a commercial transaction had been summarily stripped in Congress from student loan debt, including being able to discharge in bankruptcy, no statute of limitations. I mean, Pat, there are only five crimes that don't have statute of limitations on them: murder, treason, war crimes. Wait, murder, treason, war crimes, kidnapping, and fraud, and student loan debt. Those are the six things which in jurisprudence don't have a statute of limitations. This is madness. And so we were like, what can we do? What are some of the solutions? And we came up with one that we thought was pretty darn good. And I will say it's out of my own experience because I had a student loan debt at 7.875% interest rate, which is obscene because the banks get to borrow money from the federal government for less than 1%. So we said, what if you could refinance your student loan like you can a mortgage? And with leadership of then State Senator Dave Hansen and State Representative Corey Mason, we put out the Higher Ed Lower Debt Bill, you know, which was about allowing you to refinance your student loan like you can a mortgage, like you can any other thing. Every single Democrat for 6 years in the state legislature was a co-author of that bill. It's unheard of. No other bill like it, you know, had ever had that sort of overwhelmingly unquestionable, unflinching support. The Republicans blocked it every single time. Every single time we tried. Scott Walker's solution for it was to say, well, you should call a bank. Well, Scott Walker himself had, you know, enormous student loan debt from his kids, and he had never done that, tried to refinance with a bank, or he was unsuccessful. So his very solution didn't work. So lo and behold, we spent like 10 years trying to get people to talk about student debt, and they started, and now this wonderful movement, you know, built. And they actually, like, we got to the point where, like, people were saying, wait a second, it's not just about canceling the interest. We should cancel the debt because these people have obtained debt under a false, you know, an unfair system, and we should start canceling debt. And lo and behold, you know, President Biden announces he's going to cancel $10,000 of student debt, $20,000 in some instances. It's going to affect 20 million people, including 750,000 here in the state of Wisconsin. And not me, because I had my final payment on my 44th birthday about 9 years ago, which was like being paroled in some ways, mm-hmm. you know, because again, you don't have that monthly like $600, $700 bill every month that keeps you from being able to do things like buy a house, buy a new car, save for your kids' education, all that stuff. And I mean, it's just, we're putting money in people's pockets, you know? And the Democrats aren't saying a word about it. And it is confounding, Pat.
That's confounding. I'm going to leave it at that. Because the last Marquette poll, again, showed that the number of people opposed to Biden forgiving student loan debt was higher than those that supported, which I guess wasn't entirely unexpected, given that this is a, you know, relatively recent development, not to you and me, but to, you know, a lot of folks out there. But I do agree with you that I think, by and large, when I was on day one shouting from the rooftops how great this was going to be for local economies, for car dealers, for realtors, for everything else, I haven't heard much about it since, to be honest, of these kinds of benefits.
Hey, listen, you know, since the press like does stenography and has done stenography for Charles Franklin's polls for 10 years, he put a poll out like just a few days ago that showed 59% of voters favor strongly or somewhat the plan of $20,000 of student loan forgiveness, and only 40 oppose it strongly or somewhat. He did like a national poll or whatever, and it says it overwhelmingly, you know, that, you know, Democrats, 89% of Democrats favor it, 59% of independents, and even 25% of Republicans. It is madness, Pat, that our people aren't talking about putting money into your pocket. It's crazy. And the reason it's happening, and I'm going to say it straight up, the reason it's happening is because we have too many people in charge, particularly the consultants from DC, who have never experienced the idea of student loan debt. So they don't get it. They're rich. They're come from rich families, and they don't get what this is. And that's why. And the simple fact is that elections are about who's going to go out and vote. And we did a poll back in 2013, okay? And in specific, we wanted to find out, and I spent a fortune on this thing. Specific, we wanted to find out, Pat, could this motivate voters with student loan debt to vote? And what we found in off-year elections, and what we found out was that 61% of voting households in off-year elections have experienced current or student or former student loan debt. And it makes sense because people with student loan debt are educated, and people who have an education are more likely to go to the polls and vote. It doesn't mean that you have to have a college degree to go to vote. It doesn't mean you have to be a high school graduate to go and vote. It just means that as a population, as a demographic, if you have an education, you're more likely to be a voter. It's as simple as that. And so the idea that our candidates up and down the ticket aren't screaming at the top of their lungs, for instance, hey, Democrats are giving you $10,000. Democrats are giving you $20,000. Not to give you money, but so that you have your chance to buy cars, to buy homes, to save for your kids, to help your parents, to do all of the things like a pension. You know, Gen X is the first demographic that doesn't have employer-provided pensions, things like that, all of these things. And the idea that they're not talking about it is madness, Pat. It is madness because Republicans will give trillions of dollars of our money to the top 0.1%, and they'll scream, yeah, these 20,000 people are the job creators, so we're going to give them your money. And we're talking about 20 million people, including 750,000 of them in the state of Wisconsin, the vast majority of which are going to be voters in this election.
Last question to ask on that is to, we've talked about the benefit to young families by and large, but I don't know if we mentioned that what student loan debt is across the age spectrum. And I mean, the first time I heard about Social Security payments yep. being garnished was, yep. you know, I don't think enough people understand how yep. big this problem had become.
Agreed. The biggest demographic growth of the last like 5 years, 7 years in student loan debt is for people who are over the age of like 55, 60, because they're taking on their kids or their grandchildren. And in fact, I was on a TV show back in 2013, and I made the audience gasp on television about this, which was that in the year before, 120,000 seniors over the age of 60 had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt in 2013. And we know things have not gotten better since then. Everything's just gotten incredibly worse. So it's even worse. And again, it's not about like giving people money. It's about what they're going to do with the money. They're going to drive our economy. And, you know, you're in rural Wisconsin, Pat. Like when we talk about getting rid of Social Security or Medicaid, the only reason you have restaurants and hospitals and bars and grocery stores in rural Wisconsin is because of Social Security and Medicare. Like, that's the only reason, because that's where people use that money and spend it to make the economy grow. So young people, middle-aged people having more money because of the student loan forgiveness is going to just make the economy even stronger. No doubt about that.
I got time for one more question, and it's not even a question. I just have to take a victory lap with somebody, and that is that from the day that Tim Michaels won the primary, and we mentioned his extreme position on abortion, I said, oh, he'll tack back toward the middle at some point. He's going to backpedal at some point. And for the longest time, I had to say on air, it looks like I might have been wrong, until I wasn't wrong late last week. So I'm just taking that victory lap with you, that we did see this coming, that he was going to try to, you know, backpedal and not be as extreme as he actually is.
Yeah, it's for sure. He's trying to couch things, and he can't hide from his record. I mean, and you know, the ideological consistency is the hobgoblin of the small-minded, Pat. You know that.
I have to ask from a personal standpoint, because this might be the first time this has ever happened. Anybody who knows you well knows your envelope method. Did you make an envelope for me today?
Pat, I want to just say this, and this isn't because of a lack of respect for your show, but this is just stuff that I've talked so much about that I did not actually need an envelope to talk about student loan debt. I made a couple notes for myself about the racism stuff, but here is an envelope, a model of an envelope. So it was close to my heart.
If you ever need to, hand some money over to somebody, one of the best things you could do would be to invite Scott Ross to teach you his envelope method for doing interviews, and how just on the back of an envelope with just a couple of points, you cannot stumble and and look befuddled on air.
Pat, I appreciate you saying that. I'm just going to say that, you know, like the Joker said in The Dark Knight, if you're good at something, never do it for free. But I never, ever, ever charge anybody to teach them about using the envelope, just for the record.
I just figured it. Somebody that you're not going to know very well. But hey, if you're willing to take it on that way, you do everybody a favor and help them look good on radio and TV. Scott, I miss you. I'm so glad to get to see you at least two-dimensionally, and I look forward to another visit soon.
That sounds great, Pat. Thank you very, very much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Have a great week. We'll wrap up this hour's conversation right after this. You're up north. Welcome back. I'm going to give my little disclaimer again because I hear a three-year-old having a tantrum from another room. Is at some point, two of the grandkids are visiting for this week. So three-year-old Teddy and one six-month-old Charlotte are going to come a call in at some point here. And hopefully it's not while we're trying to make a super serious point. But even if it is, it's good perspective, you know, that not everybody is taking you seriously. They might be 3 years old, but they're not taking you taking you as seriously. I want to remind you that voting is now underway. And it feels a little, I'm sure it feels a little weird to maybe hear that, but the people who have previously requested that absentee ballots be sent to them, in other words, the early birds are getting the worm. They have started getting them in the mail, which means they are filling them out almost as we speak, and are starting to return them by mail this week. So the first votes are already being cast for November. The next steps will be either early in-person absentee voting at your local clerk's office. You can do that. Just go to your clerk's office website or give them a call and find out, because there are specific hours for early voting. Or there is still time to request that an absentee ballot be mailed to you and then mail it back. If you think that's the route that you want to go, do it right away, because we know that this is still Louis DeJoy's postal office, and the U.S. Postal Service is a great place, but not nearly as good as it could be because of this Trump appointee and some others who have tried to kill it with a million paper cuts and some big whacks. So there's nothing wrong with doing a mailed absentee ballot, but you got to be earlier than maybe you used to be. Otherwise, again, go to your clerk's website and see about in-person absentee balloting. And in case you're asking, what have I got against voting on actual election day? Nothing. But as Scott Ross mentioned, you get some long lines and people say, it's not worth it. And it doesn't have to be that way. There's no reason why democracy can't run more smoothly. But when you look at, say, Georgia, where they made it illegal to give water or food to people standing in line to vote, I mean, it just gives away a game. It gives away the game that this is what they, the Republicans, want to do. They want to make voting a challenge, so challenging that maybe you won't, because then it increases their odds of winning. It is something that is, you know, just it's insidious. It's on par with what Governors Abbott and DeSantis are doing with, you know, human trafficking of undocumented immigrants. And you know, one of the things I really liked about when Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg was running for president was that he could take any issue and synthesize it down to the bare bones and make it completely understandable. And it was why I would have been thoroughly happy had he become the nominee in 2020 or at some point in the future. And so I offer this up as an example of this is just at a Texas conference late last week or over the weekend among progressives. And he was asked about what Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is doing with, you know, shipping these poor innocent people to other states. And here's what Buttigieg had to say about that. Pete Buttigieg, really just putting things into perspective. It's part of why we sometimes hear people describing the repeal of Roe v. Wade as the Republicans catching the car, you know, and then not like a dog, not knowing what to do with it after you've chased the car. They got decades of traction from making noise about Roe v. Wade, but there was never any serious effort to do anything other than, you know, make abortion care, you know, put up some more barriers, have some more talking points about it. And then eventually they confirmed enough justices that enabled them to do it. And perhaps they thought that after decades of trying to demonize this part of healthcare, that they would get away with it. And it's still possible that they could get away with it, depending on how things go this November. But it doesn't really look like that. It looks like, again, the voter registrations continue to show the number of women registering to vote, the number of young people registering to vote is going through the roof. Now, again, it all always comes down to turnout, which is why I mentioned early voting rather than waiting until November. If there's an issue you feel strongly about and you're ready to cast ballots on that, then that's you go ahead and do that, because that window is opening even as we speak. And what do you think is going to be the situation in Wisconsin if we end up with a governor who is trying to out-Trump Trump? He will try to out-DeSantis DeSantis. He will try to out-Abbott Abbott. And that's what we face with, you know, Tim Michaels winning the governorship. It's what we face if Derek Van Orden wins the congressional race in the 3rd Congressional District. And again, you know, in the case of Van Orden, big props to whoever doing his TV ads, because they are certainly making him just look like your friendly neighbor next door who happens to own a motorcycle and, you know, says all the right things about, oh, politicians this and politicians that. Because Van Orden's not going to tell you in his commercial just how extreme his views are and the things that he and Michaels will embrace if they're put in charge in terms of abortion care, in terms of your voting rights, in terms of how they will treat people, fellow human beings, whether they are undocumented immigrants or what have you. And we've talked about how reliant the Wisconsin agriculture industry is on immigrants. The need is there for immigration reform, not immigration demonization. And now, having seen what happened with Roe v. Wade, what do you think these people will do if they get into office? State Senator Kelderoy joins us in our next hour. You're up north.